what you want, when you want it, where you want it. This is The Mesh.
This episode of the Caregiver Community is sponsored by Pace at Home. During this uncertain time, Pace at Home is enrolling participants who wish to continue to remain at home. Partnering with families, Pace at Home provides caring medical support for all of our program's participants. Visit us on our website or give us a call at 828-468-3980 to talk with a representative that can discuss with you the Pace at Home all-inclusive medical approach. Pace at Home is the champion for seniors wishing to remain in their community.
Welcome to the Caregiver Community. This is a place where we talk about the joys and the challenges of caring for our aging parents and loved ones, as well as we care for ourselves. I am Frances Hall, founder and executive director of ACAP Community, Adult Children of Aging Parents. In this podcast, we're talking about the caregiver employee, challenges, caregivers' experience in the workplace, employer viewpoints, and considerations to help lessen the impact of caregiving on the caregiver employee and the employer. I am delighted to be joined by Karen Cavanaugh. Karen is the Chief Officer for Strategic Initiatives at the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregivers. In her role, Karen provides leadership for the development and launch of the Institute's initiatives that are designed to strengthen caregiver health, resilience, and well-being. Her portfolio includes Working While Caring, an effort aimed at deepening research on effective workplace supports for caregivers and expanding access to those supports. Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Frances. It's nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me and the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregivers.
Absolutely. Thank you. We're delighted. Okay. So let's start at the beginning. I know you all have done a lot of research, and I'm so grateful for what the Rosalind Carter Institute does. But let me hit some high points, and then let's kind of unpack all of that. So what you all have found recently is that in addition to the paid job, 1 in 5 full-time caregivers who are employees also are providing care to someone who is aging, ill, or disabled. 1 in 5, 20%. 60% of caregiver employees experience disruptions to their work because of caregiver responsibilities. And on an average, caregivers who also are employed miss 3.2 days every month because of caregiving. And 1/3 of the caregiver employees have to leave work because of caregiver demands. That is, I'm just like, wow, that is huge. That is just huge. So you headed the research that you all did, Working While Caring. How about talking about what you found about the caregiver employee situation and just more of what you all found?
Sure. Yes, those are really significant numbers. I always like to start by stating out loud Mrs. Carter's famous quote that there are only 4 kinds of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who are caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who need them. So the numbers are not actually surprising, especially with current demographics and aging population. People who have been in this space for a long time have been raising this flag that this day was coming when we were going to have a very significant older population, older adult population, and even that is sequenced a bit into the very old. And that's happening right now. So we like to talk about caregiving for someone who is aging, ill, or disabled as a life cycle event, not a one-off, an experience actually that many people will have more than once in their lives. But it's systemic treatment in public policy, healthcare, and employment still does not recognize this. It is still treated as a one-off experience with siloed supports and insufficient consideration. So what we are trying to do at the Institute and what Mrs. Carter taught us to do was to really center the person who is providing the care, regardless of the relationship to the care recipient, regardless of the care recipient's condition or disease state, that there were, while there are differences and complexity in the experiences of care, there are also a number of commonalities. And one of them is that the majority of people who are providing care are also working at a paid job. So our Working While Caring initiative is really designed to advance three objectives in service of two pretty significant goals. The first is to raise awareness of employee caregivers. Again, we define those as people who are working while also caring for someone who is aging, ill, or disabled. So it's not childcare per se, unless a child is seriously ill or has some sort of condition that requires I even sort of hesitate to say this, but a higher intensity or a very different kind of care. And again, this is a growing, a very significant part of the workforce and a growing cohort of the workforce. And so we're going to do this by working specifically with employers, by trying to reduce the gap in what we know about the effects of providing care on both labor market participation and financial security on the employee side and for the employer, effects on recruitment, retention, productivity, and engagement. Because right now, while we know a fair bit about the experience and how difficult it can be to balance both, although the majority of people who are working while caring want to do both, they just want more supports. So again, while we know a fair bit about that, what we don't know a lot about are what are effective supports that keep somebody attached to the labor market while helping to reduce somewhat the strain that they feel of balancing both of the roles. And so the numbers that you cited were from our 2021 National Survey of Employee Caregivers that really sought to understand the experience in their own words. We also sort of probed on some public policy initiatives that were active at the time about support for those. We also released in 2021 a follow-on report in our Working While Caring series that really attempted to kind of set the table on again, what we know and what we don't know about the experience for both employee caregivers and the effects for employers. This report is entitled Invisible Overtime. It was really targeted to employers. And then finally, and this is the big piece and the most exciting piece of our initiative for me, we are working directly with employers through an innovation lab approach, which brings them together with their peers and gives them some expertise and some time to really think more about this cohort of the workforce. What are they doing now? What are their challenges? What are their opportunities? With the goal of really coming up with an action step that seeks to experiment with a new or slightly revised approach to supporting employee caregivers. So we just concluded, or very close to concluding, the first innovation lab with five employers located in Michigan. A few of them also have workforces in other states as well, but primarily in Michigan. And that is the topic of our last report that we just released last month on the Innovation Lab.
And I want to talk more about that in a few minutes. But it's interesting, you were talking about the supports that caregivers are wanting and needing, and yet trying to really understand better what that is. Just yesterday, I had heard, I heard that the Alzheimer's Association has just recently evidently done a survey, and that they too are finding that of the people, of those who are caring for someone, a family member or a loved one with Alzheimer's, that what they are saying is exactly what you just said, that they want to be working, they want to be engaged, they want to, for their lives to be, and they need for their lives to be beyond the caregiver situation. But what they are looking for is a support or supportive structures that will help them do both, to care well for their loved one, but also to be able to be engaged in their own lives and particularly work, because then that starts impact if with the statistic of the number of people whose jobs are jeopardized or are having to come out of work, then that has all kinds of rippling effects, not only for right now financially, but for their entire future. And so it's a huge issue that people just are looking for the support, just the support.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that employers can do that is incredibly important and came out of our innovation lab as well, is to create an environment, a culture of inclusivity, one that recognizes that employees will, at some point in their career, be providing care for someone who is aging, ill, or disabled. To really normalize that within the workplace, just like parenting is. Do not treat it as a one-off, and that supervisors and managers are trained. Everybody is actually trained. Many of us work in teams. And so, if somebody has to take a day off, if someone needs some extended period of time off, or if there needs to be flexibility in a schedule or the time frame, or if someone needs to work, as they say, in an asynchronous way from time to time, that is simply expected, and that there are actually supports in place to help managers and supervisors and teams and employees adapt to that and adjust to that. Because again, likely all of us will cycle through this experience at least once in our lifetimes while we are working.
Yeah, and I love that comparison with the being a parent, that since women have been in the workforce for so long and in such numbers, that it's pretty expected that younger women are going to need to take time to have maternity leave and that to raise children, that there's going to be that impact, but that it's okay and it's expected. And so, yeah, I love that concept of making this as normal in the workplace and as normal, very honestly, in our own thinking as parenting is. Let's talk for a moment. You and you all, Ross and Carter Institute and Duke University, are doing some collaboration, and really making sure, trying to make sure that the caregiver experience and impact are in the forefront, as I'm understanding what you all are doing. Tell us more about all of that, because I think what you really are looking at is how, and I think you're calling it profiles of courage. I think that's probably true too. Profiles of caregiving, that how it jeopardizes not only the individual caregiver, but also how it jeopardizes our healthcare system, our economy, our communities, as well as the employer. Talk some about that, please.
Sure. So I'll back up a little bit also to tell you kind of where how we began thinking about this, which is also attached to the employer work or working while caring. And so there, as you well know, caring for someone who is aging, ill, or disabled is not a homogenous experience. There are there are different experiences of providing care. And if you don't spend time thinking about this, or if you haven't had an experience yet yourself, it can get a little bit overwhelming when you start to consider this, especially for policymakers or employers. One of the questions that we received from employers early on is, well, what am I trying to solve for? Does somebody need 6 weeks of leave? Does somebody need 3 weeks? Does somebody need intermittent? Do they need flexibility? Do they need support in other ways? Of which we say yes, all of those and more. But it's a really good question. So this complexity in care really challenges, right? The there's no silver bullet in this space, and it challenges us when we're thinking about programmatic and policy supports or solutions because of that complexity. That's one piece. The other piece for employers is industry sectors are really different. Workflow is really different. Flexibility, remote work can be easily offered and adjusted to for some sectors, just like you and I are doing right now, but it's almost impossible for many others. I'm thinking about healthcare systems, retail, manufacturing, where people have to be on the floor, on the shop floor, in the hospital, in a clinic, in the store. So these are two really significant pieces that we've been thinking about. And just on the latter, want to point out that where we are focused on with Working While Caring is really on those sectors where work cannot be done remotely, or where flexibility needs to be thought about in a really different, more creative way. So oftentimes that means small and medium-sized employers, sometimes crosswalked with hourly workers, not always, or larger organizations with a workforce, again, where work cannot be done remotely. So really trying to think through solutions for those employers and those employee caregivers. So now with the profiles, then the question is, okay, so what are we trying to solve for? So with our partners at Duke University, we started with how can we put some organization around such a complex variety of experiences? Again, for someone who is providing care for someone who's aging, ill, or disabled. And how can we really move the caregiver from the margins to the center to really think about what is the experience for that person? Not that the care recipient is not important, the care dyad certainly is. But how do we think about this while being, I'll describe it this way, agnostic again to the disease state or the condition of the care recipient? So with Duke, we embarked on a very robust and rigorous process. Looking at the existing literature, we also conducted a number of focus groups and conversations with a diverse array of caregivers, and we also set up an advisory committee. I just want to give a shout out to our amazing advisory committee. These are people who expertise in caregiving and oftentimes their own experiences providing care, and then some caregivers as well. Again, caring for someone with dementia, a child with a developmental disability who is now not aging, but is more than 18 years old, cancer diagnoses. So what we have now are 10 profiles that really attempt to distill the particular phase of care, the most salient goals of the care giver and care recipient dyad, and then the most significant sources of strain during each of these phases. So these profiles were not intended. Of course, they're not linear. It's not like you progress through each of them. In fact, somebody may start kind of in the middle, and they may go back and forth through different phases. So for example, someone may overnight become a caregiver with no warning. Perhaps someone has been in a catastrophic accident that completely changes their mobility. And perhaps the caregiver is the wife of this person, and there are young children in the home. So you just sort of think about there's, you know, an overnight change. There is a change in mobility. There is, you know, there are questions about the permanence of that change. There's treatment options at that point in time. There's potentially, you know, changes in the home. There are likely changes to consider about the work status for both the caregiver and the care recipient. There are then really significant psychological changes and stressors at that point in time. That's one profile. Another profile may be somebody who is in the kind of in the, I'm going to say, the middle of the journey, taking care of someone, let's say with a cancer diagnosis, where the prognosis is somewhat unpredictable. And there may be a variety of treatment options that change over time, depending on how the care recipient is responding. Certainly they would have, you know, the psychological strain. They likely also have financial strain, workplace strain. So some of the sources of strain are certainly evident in each of the profiles, but can take on a little bit of a different color or complexity based on the phase. So that's another one. And yet another one is the end of life with someone, where somebody is managing with someone who is at the end of their life. And then finally, we thought that this was really important. It showed up in the literature, and it was really discussed a lot with our caregivers, being a former caregiver, either because the care recipient has passed or because the care recipient has, for example, gone through cancer treatment and they are in remission and life, I'm putting this in air quotes because I know your audience can't see us, returns to normal. But actually having a very intense caregiving experience is defining. And you don't necessarily then switch back. So we thought that that was a really important profile as well. So we did this again, you know, to help to answer some of the questions with employers. What am I solving for? So how that might be implemented with an employer is to say, you know, okay, here are the profiles of caregiving experiences. Do you have supports and accommodations that could help someone in each of these phases? So that is also where, as I talked about former caregivers, this is also where we talk a bit about anticipatory grief and bereavement, if that happens to be the case, and, you know, thinking about supports for those employee caregivers. We also think that this could be hugely important and impactful in the healthcare system, for example, for programmatic and policy, to inform programs and policies, and then finally to target resources, perhaps to anticipate where somebody might be and to engage with them, rather than, you know, having a caregiver have yet another to-do on their to-do list. You know, how can the system more proactively engage and reach out and offer support to caregivers?
There is so much in what you have just said. Having been at somewhat all three of those points along the way, you're absolutely correct. It is very different depending on where you are in that caregiver journey. It's very different. And what the caregiver is needing from the employer, from the whole community, can be very different at those different places, those different points along the way. I applaud what you all are doing because it certainly gives voice to the caregiver in a very different way than just one person sort of raising the flag and saying, I need some help here. So thank you for that. Absolutely. We've talked a lot about the caregiver situation and what can be and what employers can do. Why should they? How does it benefit the employer? I think that would be a really, I think in addition to what is the question we're trying to answer for the caregiver, I think for the employer, that they too are looking for what's in it for me? How does it help me? So can you speak to that?
Sure. And I'm just going to pull from the voices of the employers we have been working with. When we first talked to them about this initiative, mostly we did not have to convince them that this was an issue. They were already seeing it within their workforce, and they were already struggling with recruitment, retention, and engagement. And they just didn't really know, well, what should we be doing? What are effective supports? What can we experiment with? And they would also say that those who are providing, care for someone who is aging, ill, or disabled in general, and this is a broad stroke, I understand, are not as vocal as perhaps a parent to a child about what they need. There's a lot of still stigma around providing care, and particularly if you're thinking about someone who's providing care to someone with a mental health condition or a substance use disorder, people don't really want to talk about those details. So what's in it for the employers, if it's done, in a high quality way, is first and foremost, again, a recognition that we will all have this experience at least once in our lifetimes, and we are normalizing this within the workplace. And so we are engaging you as a whole human, as you are, or as you might be with this experience, which, when employees feel that they are seen, when they feel that, their whole selves are considered, not just their work self, if you will, this has been shown to, increase engagement, loyalty, productivity, creativity. I just this morning was reading something about interdependence. And, folks don't often want to talk about this in the workplace, but we are all interdependent, regardless of where we are in our lives. So there's that, just setting an organizational culture that, recognizes and supports employee caregivers. Employers were telling us too that they were losing really key skills, talent, institutional knowledge, because they could not figure out how to help somebody who had to make a decision of whether to stay within the workforce or leave, separate to provide care. So that is really, really important to employers. And as you know, recruitment, retention, retraining, it's a really expensive endeavor. So if employers can keep somebody, even if they have to provide accommodations of some sort, that's far more efficient for them, and it really helps their bottom line. So that's with what is for them. But I do want to say this, Frances, because we didn't talk about this at the top of the conversation. Part of our initiative with Working While Caring is to engage employers directly, to partner with them, to learn more about what is effective for this cohort of the workforce. But we always say that while we know employers can do more for their employee caregivers or do some things differently, and that's not a criticism, we also recognize that they cannot solve for all of the outcomes that result from such a fragmented and dysfunctional long-term care system. I don't even like to call it a system that we have in this country. For example, as you know, navigating the healthcare system is really, really difficult, and it is a significant source of strain for caregivers, whether they're employed or not. The lack of financing options is another. So those are public policy issues that really have to be solved. And so our theory of change, if you will, is to engage employers, sort of appeal to their self-interest on workforce, retention, recruitment, productivity, engagement, but then over time to help them to understand and to connect the dots between what they are seeing in their workforce and the public policy context. And so could we organize them to become more vocal agents for reform and change at that level?
What you just said really reminds me, you were talking earlier about the interdependence of all of us, but it's almost like our systems also are interdependent.
Yes.
What is happening in healthcare is affecting what's happening in the employer, for the employer, and vice versa. And, all of these systems, all of these different pieces that seem so completely separate and disconnected, are very much connected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So all of this is really, really good information. And it really does make sense to care for the caregiver, for the employer to be attentive in caring for the caregiver, because not only is it caring for the caregiver, caring for that person who is part of their family, their team, but it also very honestly is good for their bottom line, for the companies. Bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Talk about what kinds of policies and practices, sort of typical policies and practice, both help, both support caregivers, as well as throw up some real obstacles. Are there some kind of typical ones that surface in both of those categories?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, again, I want to start with the organizational culture, which, it gets overlooked sometimes, but it's really, really critical, normalizing this type of care within the workforce. Now, it does have to be backed up, though, with real supports. And, you can't just say, yes, we see you, and then have no supports available when someone needs that. So I will say that, but I just want to underscore how important that is. And sometimes that, that gets entitled as organizational culture or a caregiver-friendly workplace, that sort of thing. So some of the easier lifts there are supporting an employee resource group of caregivers, providing them with the time paid to come together, providing them with some resources, space, a lunch to share with their peers. That's an easy thing. Having a CEO or executive team talk about their own caregiving experiences. Again, all in addition to having real supports. Flexibility in the workplace is the top request of employee caregivers. And again, even if you cannot work remotely, there are ways to incorporate flexibility through schedule autonomy, for example, being able to switch shifts with someone without having to seek permission to do that, and being able to do that in a short period of time. You know, maybe you learn, I'm needed with mom in an hour, and you're able to swap with it. So that type of flexibility in terms of the actual work, you know, I talk about teams, you know, can you, when someone needs to go out or there needs to be adjustment in their schedule, how can you sort of adjust the workflow in a way where the work still gets accomplished, but it may be getting done in a slightly different way. Another really important piece, there's a few things that kind of occur outside of the employer context, if you will, but that employers can influence and shape. So one of them is ensuring that you have healthcare coverage that has mental health parity, real parity, and that psychotherapy counseling is covered, a sufficient number of sessions, not just three and done, and that there's, you know, there are experts in care who can provide this kind of support to an employee caregiver. So again, employers can do that through their healthcare coverage. They can also require that, you know, many employers have EAPs and they are underutilized. That's correct. Often employees do not want to use them. But if they have them, they should ensure that the services that they provide really include those who have expertise in caregiving. They understand the stresses, they understand the strain, and that they understand the local context of home and community-based services, that they understand Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance coverage. They understand some of the, even the appeals process to help an employee caregiver navigate that. There's a couple of other evidence-based activities, initiatives that really help caregivers. One of them is ensuring that they are really part of the care team, that they are seen and that they are respected and heard. That's something that, you know, again, that occurs outside of the employer context, but it's something that employers could talk about as being really, really important, you know, with their peers within that broader sort of ecosystem, right? Another one is when employee caregivers or any caregiver is connected to a formal service. So it may be a support service for themselves, or it may be access to in-home care. So ensuring, again, this starts to get into the public policy and programmatic context that's outside of the employer environment, but that is where employers can begin to push to ensure that there are high quality services that are accessible and affordable. And also navigation, helping employees to navigate that healthcare system. So some of these things are not going to happen overnight. Some of them we've been talking about for a very, very long period of time, right? And they still need some work. But, you know, two things that are very encouraging. The CMS has now launched the Dementia Guide pilot that includes, requires robust caregiver supports. And so they will be evaluating that. And hopefully that can be expanded to caregivers of those, you know, with other types of conditions and diseases outside of dementia. The other one is the 2024 physician fee schedule, which for the first time will cover physician training for caregivers. Now, there are some there's some pretty significant structural issues there, but this is pretty much a, this is a really big change that we should be paying attention to and helping to support in any way that we can.
I love that list because there really are so many things that employers can do, from almost benign to some really pretty extensive and involved pieces that they can offer, that all of these support caregivers at kind of wherever they are. Interestingly, your very first one was about allowing employees to gather and to share and to talk. And that really is how ACAP began.
Oh.
So it's interesting that was the very
I would also be really remiss if I didn't say, you know, if we could have a paid family and medical leave policy in this country that it, you know, is a national policy that is uniform for all employees, for all sectors across states, that would be really helpful as well when people need that.
So we hope that day will come, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
So on the flip side, should we even dare talk about any of the policies and practices that can be really difficult? You've talked about culture, and certainly the culture that says it's okay for a caregiver employee to say, this is what's going on, or to say, I may need to come in late, leave early, take some time off. I may need some time during the workday to make some appointments or whatever. I'll make up the time. We're not asking for people to be allowed not to produce, not to be productive in their jobs. That's not what this is about. It is simply really to provide the supports and the structure so that employees who are also caregivers can be the maximum at both, that they continue to produce for the employer, but they also are taking care of their loved one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But are there some particular things that employers kind of need to, it would be helpful for them to be on the lookout for, anything in particular?
Do you mean like in policies or?
Policies, practices. Is there anything that has surfaced a number of times beyond what you've already said? Is there anything that has surfaced a number of times that employees are saying, if my company would do X, it would be really helpful to me?
You know, probably that's paid leave. You know, that is in part why I think it has not passed yet in this country, is for some employers, they believe it will just be impossible for them to remain competitive. They don't believe that they can incur those costs through, you know, not having a person sort of in the seat or on the line. So that is something that, you know, the employers we have worked with, they all have paid leave policies. And they will say that, you know, it is helpful to people. It's not a silver bullet though. But it can be difficult to implement.
Sure. I know one of the things that happened for me that was extremely helpful and just so incredible was that I was on a small university campus, and other faculty and staff, I guess, could donate some of their hours, which was just so helpful. And it was just really great. So.
Yeah. Some employers definitely are offer that. And yes, the public sector, that appears to be a pretty prevalent benefit within the public sector.
Right. Karen, all of this is such good information. Is there anything that we haven't covered? Or let me take that back. There is a lot we haven't been able to cover, and I know that. But are there some other things that we really need to talk about and make sure that people know about, and specifically employers are aware of through this podcast?
I don't think anything other than what I've already said, again, that this is a really critical cohort of the workforce. It's really important to normalize this and to recognize this type of care within the workforce, to offer supports, to train supervisors and managers, and to have an eye out on the public policy context as well. But I would love to ask you, Frances, after spending the last 50 minutes with me, is there anything that we are not considering through this work that you would like us to consider? Is there something we've sort of overlooked, do you think? Or what resonated or not with your own experience?
I think that you all are really on target of providing the research, the real underpinnings and the data that helps give a voice to caregivers. And I recently heard a statistic, and I haven't had a chance to really follow up with this, but the statistic was that 50% of people over the age of 45 are in a caregiver situation, not for as a parent, but for an older loved one. And I thought, holy mackerel, just the implications of that. So I think that what you all are doing is really vital, because the reality is those of us who were working or are working and caring for someone, there are so many different pieces of that. And if we are in a culture, an employer or an employment culture that doesn't understand, or that we feel like we can't share that and we can't be honest and transparent about what all the implications for our lives and how we may be on the job, but we may not be able to give full attention because mom or dad or spouse or partner or loved one, is in this other place, and we kind of, have to be looking both ways all the time and concerned for both situations all the time. So everything that you all are doing, I think, just is monumental in terms of helping address the dire situation, particularly knowing that the cost of caregiving, professional caregiving, the cost of assisted living and long-term care and memory care, is absolutely prohibitive for many.
Yes.
So families are having to step up, or friends are having to step up and assume responsibilities and tasks that they are absolutely not prepared for. And so what you all are doing is really helping bring that into the forefront and to normalize that, because it is normal. When you have 50% of people over the age of 45, that's a lot of our workforce, particularly key positions in our workforce. Mm-hmm. And so they are being affected so significantly, then of course the employer is going to be affected so soon.
Francis, just as you were saying that, I am reminded that in the last few weeks, NORC put out an update to their study on the forgotten middle, which is that vast swath of the population that are not eligible for Medicaid and will never be eligible for Medicaid, as well as, the cohort that could spend down to be eligible for Medicaid, but that it's just huge. And there are very few supports for that population. And therefore the financial, labor market, psychological effects are really significant all that to say, we would never say, you know, Medicaid does have a long-term care system of sorts. We would never say that that's sufficient, there's this huge swath, and most of them are working. Many are working.
Oh, absolutely. And then we combine that with the crisis in terms of the number of people who are providing the care, who are the professional caregivers.
Yes, yes.
And, I mean, we have a convergence of, I'm not sure that anybody, certainly we have known of the silver tsunami. You know, we baby boomers are, we were the ones who created all that we did relative to children. And now as we have moved through and we are now aging, and all that that means for us as an aging population. And yeah, I we were aware of that, but I don't think that we really completely figured in all of the other pieces that are now coming together to make a true crisis.
Yeah.
And I'm not meaning to end on a really difficult note, but the fact is, as you have said so beautifully, there's lots to do and lots that needs to be done so that those who are caring for some of our most vulnerable in our population, the older adult, that the caregiver is cared for, so they can do what they need to do for their loved one, but also keep our economy afloat.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the other way that we think about this as well is that caregiving can be, I do not want to suggest it always is, but it can be a very rewarding, meaningful experience for people. And yet, by taking on that experience, there are real risks to one's physical health, mental health, financial health, and labor market participation. So how do we think about, you know, really making this experience one where somebody can derive that meaning and that connection and that reward and joy and not remain healthy and whole. So that's how I'm not saying this very eloquently, but that's how I've been thinking about it as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Caregiving affects every single part of one's being. And even with that, the vast majority of caregivers, once the caregiver journey is finished, they look back and go, yes, I would do it again. Mm-hmm. And yes, to be able to support and to make sure that they are able to do all of that is huge. So thank you for what you personally are doing and what the Rosalyn Carter Institute is doing in all kinds of different ways. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Frances, for this opportunity to share the work and Mrs. Carter's vision.
Absolutely, absolutely. We also thank you. We thank the RCI, the Rosalyn Carter Institute for Caregivers. We also want to thank you, our listeners. We hope this information has been helpful to you, both as an individual and as a caregiver, but also particularly if you are an employer, if you are in a company and you have others working with you, that you are supervising or working in a team with you, please do hear this. And if you have any questions, please reach out to either Karen or to me. You can find Karen at info@rosalyncarter.org, info@rosalyncarter.org. We also want to be sure that we thank the Mesh. The Mesh Network is our recording studio for all of our online shows and podcasts. You can find more of our Caregiver Community podcasts on any of the platforms where you get podcasts. You also can find it on our website, www.acapcommunity.org. That's the ACAP community, or the ACAP website, www.acapcommunity.org. We certainly want to thank Pace at Home in Hickory, North Carolina. They are the sponsors, the sponsor for this podcast and all of our podcasts. We began this podcast with Mrs. Carter's wonderful quote, and I want to end our podcast with it. We continually say in ACAP that caregiving is an everybody issue, and that definitely is what Mrs. Carter's quote is. There are only four kinds of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who currently are caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need a caregiver. Karen, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Each of you, thank you. Stay well, everyone. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Mesh, an online media network of shows and programs ranging from business to arts, sports to entertainment, music to community. All programs are available on the website as well as through iTunes and YouTube. Check us out online at themesh.tv. Discover other network shows and give us feedback on what you just heard.